WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
In 2000, Terry interviewed David Chase at the end of the second season of The Sopranos and just days after the death of actress Nancy Marchand. Terry played a clip that day with Tony, played by James Gandolfini, sitting alone at night in his kitchen having a drink as his daughter Meadow walks in. She's played by Jamie Lynn Sigler.
Why are you sitting in the dark?
I don't know. Light the dark. Sit.
I gotta go online.
Oh, come on. Sit for a minute. Come on. So what's going on?
With what?
Whatever, I don't know. What's going on?
I just told you. The chat room. Is that it?
You know I love you, right, man?
Dad.
No, don't dad me. Come on. I want to know. Do you know that I love you?
Yes. I know that you love me.
Because your mother doesn't think I love you enough.
Can you listen to her?
Everything I do, and everything I've done, and everything I will do, it's all for you and your buddy, you know that.
I think you should go to bed.
I mean, I tell people, you're like your mother, but you're all me. Nothing gets by you. And I know you think I'm a hypocrite.
I'm going to bed.
Yeah, all right, go ahead.
Dad, why don't you go to bed?
No, I'm going to finish my drink.
Okay. Can I?
Good night, baby.
Sometimes we're all hypocrites.
Good night, baby.
Well, you're so lucky to have found in James Gandolfini someone who has such an interesting face to watch, and his face is kind of mercurial. I mean, although I'm sure he's trying not to betray what he's thinking, you can see what he's thinking on his face. And sometimes he looks very weak and vulnerable, and sometimes he's incredibly cold-blooded looking. You've cast at the center of the series someone who is a very charismatic actor, but he's not a leading man kind of looking actor. He's got a pot belly, receding hairline, pudgy face. It's not Al Pacino.
No. I always go for the actor. If the actor who came in to read for this part had been Cary Grant and it had worked, I probably would have said, fine, let's do that. But we didn't. What really we were blessed enough to have happen is that James Gandolfini came through our door. And I honestly mean this. Without Jim Gandolfini, there is no Sopranos. There's no Tony Soprano. That's why the whole thing, I think, is so identifiable to so many people, because he just is so human. And people respond to him. Their hearts and their heads go out to him, despite the heinous things he's doing on screen.
There's only a very average guy looking about him.
Oh, it's more than that. I don't think he is that average. I think he is a very, very sensitive, hypersensitive man. And I think he reflects his environment in a very, very rarefied way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And he comes off as the regular Joe, you know. But I think what's going on there is you have a very, very extremely emotional person and sensitive person. And that's what Tony Soprano has become as a result of him.
Edie Falco plays the role of Carmela. What did you tell Edie Falco about the character of Carmela after you cast her?
Nothing. Absolutely nothing. Just comes in, does her work.
Was Carmela...
No direction, honest to God. No direction, no nothing. That's the case with most of these actors. There's very little directing going on.
When you wrote the character of Carmela, Tony's wife, did you base it on any of the people who you knew from the old neighborhood where you grew up? Because you grew up in the same township that The Sopranos is set in.
Right. Right. But
when you say
the old neighborhood, I think people probably get the idea of sort of like stoops and three-story, you know, brownstone houses. I grew up in the suburbs,
mm-hmm.
And that's where The Sopranos takes place. Were there people in my town like that? I guess, actually, when I think about it, I think she reminds me somewhat of some of my cousins.
In what way?
Very direct. They'll tell you exactly what's on their mind. My cousin Diana was a lot. Now, I'm thinking about this for the first time. You asked me this. I've never thought about this before. I had a cousin, Diana Spizzato, who was much older than me, actually. She was a contemporary of my mother, but she was my cousin. She was my first cousin. She had this kind of... she was tough, and she had this kind of world-weariness about her. At the same time, she was a great mother and an extremely capable, sharp woman. But she... you could not push her. You know, if you did, you'd hear about it. She'd come back at you.
David Chase speaking to Terry Gross in the year 2000. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Interview from the year 2000 with David Chase, creator of The Sopranos. The influential HBO drama series premiered 20 years ago this week.
It seems to me that The Sopranos started off with a little bit more comedy and that it's become just more tragic for the characters as time goes on.
I know. People have said that, and I didn't realize that. I don't see it that way. So it's
you don't
really
see
difficult.
It that way?
I don't.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We had a plan for Tony's emotional growth or lack of growth throughout the first season. The idea of carried over from the first season was, okay, based on what we seem to remember about therapy or know about therapy, of course it takes much longer than this, and it's, you get to a point, my parents did this, my parents did that, you're slamming your parents, the shrink is saying, oh, those parents you had, what do you expect? You can't be any better than you are, because, and you go through that, and then you get to a point where it's okay, so your parents were your parents, now what are you going to do? You know, you're going to, as a shrink once said to me, what would you like to do? Should we have an auto da fe and burn the old lady at the stake? She's your mother. What can you do about it? And so we got to that point in the show, and the second season was about, actually, Tony realizing that people kept saying to him he was his own worst enemy, that the seeds of his own destruction and his problems were internal, as they are with all of us, really. In the end, you're here, and there's no excuses for who you are. And I thought it was also necessary to remind the audience, this is a mobster. This is a gangster. You may think he's lovable. He's also a very, very scary man.
Let's hear a scene between Tony and his psychiatrist, Dr. Melfi, from about three episodes from the end of last season. And this gets a little bit to what you're talking about. This conversation isn't about Tony's mother. It's about who Tony is and the kind of problems he's responsible for of his own volition in the work that he's doing and in the crimes that he's committing. So here's Tony with Dr. Melfi.
Do you know why a shark keeps moving?
They gotta keep moving or they'll die. They can't breathe or something.
There's a psychological condition known as alixithymia, common in certain personalities. The individual craves almost ceaseless action, which enables them to avoid acknowledging the abhorrent things they do.
Abhorrent? What certain personalities?
Antisocial personalities.
My future brother-in-law. Ran over a guy. No reason. Guy's paralyzed. Has to piss into a cathode tube. What happens when these antisocial personalities aren't distracted from the horrible they do?
They have time to think about their behavior. How what they do affects other people. About feelings of emptiness and self-loathing haunting them since childhood. And they crash.
The scene from The Sopranos, my guest is the creator and executive producer of the series, David Chase. Where does that scene take us in the development of Tony?
Well, it was intended to be building toward some sort of conclusion or some kind of self-awareness on Tony's part that he... that it's no longer, you can no longer blame your parents, your mother. You cannot go through your life or go through therapy just leaning on that crutch all the time. That after a while, it's you. The problem is you. It's strange. As you were playing that scene, I felt the scene with Melfi. I felt very sorry for Tony Soprano. I actually got choked up. I sort of heard it for the first time, because she's not only saying to him, "This is what you do to other people," but she's saying to him that underneath, there's this just little scared person who just hates himself. I felt compassion for the guy.
Do you ever hear from people who are in the mob and watch the series and comment one way or another?
No, not directly. There are people who work on the show in New York who know people who know people who know people.
Mm-hmm.
And the word has filtered back through that pipeline that the first season what we heard was they just were okay. That's all we ever heard. We're okay. But then recently, stories were printed about a Jersey crime family who FBI transcripts came out in which they talked about The Sopranos, and they felt that The Sopranos was based on them, which it isn't. I want to be quick to assure them. No, it is not at all. I mean, we make up a lot of this stuff, and it's interesting that it happens to coincide with what they feel is real life.
When you were growing up, were there movies that really scared the heck out of you, but you couldn't take your eyes off of them?
Oh, of course, yes. As I said, I was a scaredy kid, and yet horror movies and scary movies to me were, I could not get enough of them. I think a pretty big influence on me was this William Wellman movie, The Public Enemy,
mm-hmm.
which I saw on Million Dollar Movie when I was probably 8 or 9, and they would play a movie all week long. And in it, there's the gangster Tom Powers is, you know, it's the one where Cagney's finally, after this life of crime, and actually the mother is very important in that movie too. He's got this sort of sweet little old Irish mother. But after this horrible life of crime and smashing the grapefruit into that woman's face and everything else that he did, he gets shot and he says, "I ain't so tough," and he collapses on his knees. But at the end of the movie, he's in a hospital, and the rival gangs calls his mother's house and says, "We're sending Tom home." And his brother runs up the stairs and says, "Ma, Ma, they're bringing Tom home." And she puts on this I'm Forever Blowing Bubbles record, and it's playing, and she's making the bed, and she's sort of singing, and feathers are going every place. She's happy, and his brother's all excited. He's coming home, and then there's a knock on the door, and the brother opens the door, and you see Cagney's wrapped up in a blanket with his head all in bandages from the hospital, tied up like a mummy, and he's dead, and he's dead eyes, and he just sort of topples toward camera, right into the lens. That's the end of the movie. This was the most frightening thing I'd ever seen. I was scared about this for a month. I could not get that out of my mind.
What was it that was so scary?
I don't know to this day. This, the idea, those people's expectations in the house, it's actually making me kind of sad. I don't know, their expectations of what was going to happen and what really did happen, that they were so happy that he was coming home and he was dead in such a horrible way and how he'd wasted his life.
Well, David Chase, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much for talking with
Thank
us.
Thank you very much. It's been really great.
David Chase speaking to Terry Gross in the year 2000.